And we'll be in Genesis chapter 10 today. So, up until this point, we just did chapter 9 a couple of weeks ago. I missed last week due to the weather. But we saw that that Noah and his sons got off the ark and God blessed them. And he's basically establishing the rules for a brand new world. He's wiped out the old one with a flood. He's starting over again with one man, one righteous man, Noah, and his family. And there were eight souls that were saved on the ark. And then we saw in chapter 9, they get off of the ark. And God blesses them. And he makes a covenant with them. And he sets a token of a rainbow in the sky to be just a reminder of his covenant that he's not going to destroy the whole earth by a flood again. Okay? That's going to be, I think it really comes into play in these next couple of chapters as you start to see what the children of men begin to do. And then last time we saw this kind of weird thing that happened when Noah began to be an husbandman. He planted a vineyard and he got drunk and we saw kind of what happened there and what basically comes out of this. The key takeaway is that Canaan, the son of Ham, ends up being cursed through this. And we're going to see more about Canaan in this chapter. So Genesis chapter 10, we're just going to start out just reading through it. And then we'll go through it one section at a time. Actually, you know what? For the sake of time, we might just go through one section at a time and talk about it and not have to read through it all twice. Okay, so chapter 10, verse 1. And I just want to say this about Genesis chapter 10. This is Moses writing this. After the children of Israel left Egypt and they're on their way to the promised land. And this book in particular is really about roots. It's about origins. That's why it's called Genesis. It's the beginning. And this chapter, chapter 10, is particularly about roots and origins. Okay? So chapter 10, verse 1, it says, "Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were sons born after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech, and Tyrus. And the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, and Riphath, and Togarma. And the sons of Javan, Elisha, and Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, in their nations." Okay, so just some key things I want to point out. Verse 1, it says, "Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were sons born after the flood." It's significant that all of the sons of all of the sons of these three sons were all born after the flood.
Right.
If any of them were born before the flood, they would have been killed because there were only eight people on the ark. The Bible is very clear about that. So none of these sons were born before the flood or even, I don't know, maybe some of them could have been born on the ark, but it's kind of debatable. There were eight people that got on the ark, and it appears that everyone else came after the flood. Okay. And also, one other thing that's interesting about the order here is that it says the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, that's not in the order of their births. Actually, Japheth is the oldest, and he's listed last here. But then when you start going through the sons, it starts with Japheth. So verse 2, the sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech, and Tyrus. Okay, so let's talk about who these guys are. So I have a map here, and you guys all have handouts, so if you can't read what's up here, you can just look at your handout. But Japheth is all these orange guys, okay? So I put the sons of Japheth himself, I put those in bold. So you have Magog, Meshach, Madai, Tubal, Javan. And you can see on the maps, like, who these guys, some of them, like, turn into eventually. Now, this is Genesis 10. This is just kind of an overview, and it's giving, like, the origins, the roots of these nations. These aren't all established nations yet, okay? It's not like, well, just because Javan was born that suddenly there's Greece over here and everything. No, this is a man that his family became a tribe, and his tribe spread out toward this particular area. And that's what happened with all these guys, is they led a tribe, and that tribe became a nation. Now, some of them, like Javan, you see, is pretty much accepted by historians as, well, that's he became the father of the Greeks, and they settled in this area. Some of them we don't really know that clearly about. This map here I put together, I consulted about 12 other maps and just kind of made guesses about where a lot of these guys settled. But again, it's really not so much about the individuals as it is the tribe and the nation that came from them. Some of them, like Gomer up here, it's not like there was this guy named Gomer and he lived exactly right here. First of all, it's just kind of a guess. Second of all, the tribe of Gomer eventually covered all of Northern Europe. We're talking about the Germans, the Polish, the French, the English. Like, this was a huge area that this guy's tribe spread out into. Magog is another one. It's not like his tribe just settled right here. No, it was like all over this whole area here. I'm going way off the map here. But some of them are really notable, like the Greeks. It's pretty well established in history that we know who these people are, where they came from. They came from him. Another significant one is Madai. Who is the father of the Medes, that you might remember if you read the book of Daniel. If you ever heard the term Ashkenazi Jews, that's talking about Jews that are from this area, which is Central Europe and Eastern Europe. That name, Ashkenazi, it comes from this name, Ashkenaz, which is the tribe that end up inhabiting this area. And that's a term still used today. Let's see. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the individual guys, especially here. But I will point out a couple of things. Verse 5, it says, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families and their nations. So what does that mean, the isles of the Gentiles? Well, that's coming right after he mentions the sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim. And I think that particular group of his sons ended up inhabiting a lot of these little islands in the Mediterranean. And I think that's what he's referring to when he says the isles of the Gentiles. Okay? But then the next question is, what are Gentiles? You just suddenly see this term show up here, and this is the first place it's mentioned. So what are Gentiles? And a lot of times the answer that you'll hear people say is that Gentiles are non-Jews. And that's kind of true, but it's also backwards. It's not that Gentiles are non-Jews. What you're going to find out is that the Gentiles came first, and then the Jews were called out to be non-Gentiles. That's really the way the biblical order goes. But what is a Gentile? Well, basically the term Gentile is kind of synonymous with the word nations. Okay? As a matter of fact, sometimes you'll see a passage in the Old Testament that mentions Gentiles, and then in the New Testament it'll say nations. I might have that backwards. But they're kind of used interchangeably. The word nation, it has this prefix, nate. You'll see it in words like natal or nativity. It has to do with birth. It's the same thing with Gentiles. Gentile comes from a Latin word, gens, which means a clan or a family, and it has to do with birth. And you see that same root word in other words like genes, genealogy, generation, genesis. It has to do with births and beginnings, and it's from that root word that means a family or a clan. So these Gentiles, they're basically nations and families, okay? They're divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families in their nations. One thing about Gentiles is that, and I think this is kind of why they're classified as Gentiles, they're not just families, but they're kind of like, they're all about the family. They're all about the culture and the tradition. And that's just kind of the way they operate. And that's the way it's always been throughout history. Again, I mentioned that Jews were called out to become a separate people, separate from the nations, to basically be non-Gentiles. And that's because God was calling them out to say, you're going to follow me, and you're going to serve me, and you're not going to just do what your ancestors were doing. You're going to follow me instead. And we're going to see that when we get to the next couple chapters and we start talking about Abram and how God calls him out from the Gentiles. But the other thing that you'll notice here in this account about the sons of Japheth is that it's extremely short and there's not really any details given here. There's four verses in this chapter. This chapter is about the sons of Noah and their sons. There's four verses given to Japheth, and Japheth is absolutely huge. He ends up covering pretty much all of Europe and a large portion of Asia. That's a significant part of the world. But he only gives them four verses here. Compared to, we get down to the next section, there's 15 verses about the sons of Ham, and then there's I think there's 11 verses about the sons of Shem. Why doesn't he say that much about Japheth? Well, frankly, because this book is pretty well focused on this part of the earth. There's a lot of interaction with the Hamites, the children of Ham, in this area, and then also a large interaction with the children of Shem, which are in this area. And the Bible doesn't really shine a spotlight on Japheth. I'm not saying Japheth is irrelevant, but Moses is writing this as part of the history, not just of the world, but starting with the world and then focusing in on the history of Israel. Right. And Japheth doesn't really have a lot to do with that until much later on in history. So that's not where Moses focuses in this chapter. So that's pretty much Japheth. So we get down to verse 6, and then he says, and the sons of Ham, Cush, and Mizraim, and Phut, and Canaan. And the sons of Cush, Seba, and Havilah, and Sabta, and Raamah, and Sabtika. And the sons of Raamah, Sheba, and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calne, in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Asher, and builded Nineveh, and the city Rehoboth, and Calah. And Rezin, between Nineveh and Calah, the same is a great city. And Mizraim begat Ludim, and Anamim, and Lehabim, and Naphtuhim, and Pathrusim, and Casluhim, out of whom came Philistim, and Caphtorim. And Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite, and afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as thou comest to Gerar, unto Gaza, as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim, even unto Lasha. These are the sons of Ham after their families, after their tongues, in their countries, and in their nations. Okay, I need to take a breath, because that is a long passage about the sons of Ham. And you can see there's significantly more detail about the sons of Ham than there were about the sons of Japheth. Okay, so who are the sons of Ham? You can see from this map, again, I color-coded it so it would be easier to see. Japheth mostly spread out toward the north and even kind of eventually toward the east. Ham is mostly going down into the south, into Africa. Okay? The notable exception is Canaan, and he mentions all these tribes that come out of Canaan, and they're pretty much all focused here in the land of Canaan. This area of the map is like a big cluster. There's all these different tribes all kind of huddled in this one area, and they all came out of Canaan. Canaan eventually is going to be driven out of this land when the Israelites come out of Egypt. Again, Canaan was cursed, and God is going to give the Jews, the Hebrews, this land. So when they come out of Egypt, they're going to conquer this land and overthrow these tribes. And that's what they were supposed to do. So let's take a little bit more time to look at Ham. Okay, so verse 6, it says, the sons of Ham, Cush, that would end up being Ethiopia. Mizraim, that's Egypt. And Phut, that's Libya, and Canaan. So three of these nations you can see are African. And then there's Canaan, who's in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Cush, Seba, and Havilah, and Sabta, and Raamah, and Sabtika. And the sons of Raamah, Sheba, and Dedan. And I'm not going to go through all these guys one at a time. You can pretty much look on the map and get at least an estimation of where those tribes ended up settling. But where it starts to get interesting for us is in verse 8. It says, and Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. Okay, let's talk about this guy, Nimrod. It says that that he was a mighty one. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. That's interesting. You have this person who created the world and created everything in it and gave dominion to man, but he is the head over all. He is the Lord. That is God. Okay? Then you have one of these creatures, these lowly creatures, they're called humans because they're supposed to be humble, right? You have this guy called Nimrod. It says he began to be a mighty one in the earth. The last time we read about mighty, we're going back to Genesis 6, and it talks about the giants. They bear children to them. The same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. And God, you know, whatever happened there, I know we've had some discussion about that. Whatever happened in that chapter, it was not acceptable to God. God was not pleased by that. And here you have this guy called Nimrod exalting himself and becoming mighty in the earth. I don't believe Nimrod was a giant. And the reason why I don't believe that is because you have his whole genealogy. He's a grandson of Noah. Noah, Ham, Kush, Nimrod. So great-grandson of Noah, if I have that right. But we know exactly where this guy came from. Now, it says that he was mighty in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean he hunted animals? It could. Now, there's not a lot of detail about this given here, but there are some possibilities that I've considered. First of all, he began to be a king. You see in verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom. Okay? So this was a man who started a kingdom. And the way I could see this happening is that, okay, you get off the ark. These families start to grow. These tribes start to grow. And animals begin to reproduce. And in these days, you know, there's some pretty big animals. You read them about them in the book of Job. There's things called Leviathan and Behemoth. And we see these fossils about these giant creatures. We call them dinosaurs, okay? There's some pretty big beasts roaming the earth. Well, if you wanted to make a name for yourself in those days, one of the ways you could probably do that is by becoming a mighty hunter and slaying some of these beasts and making yourself out to be some great one, right? I see that as one possibility. That might have been how this guy got a following. That you go out and slay this dragon or whatever, and then people are like, wow, look at this guy. That's an impressive leader. Let's follow him. That's one possibility. But there's other possibilities as well. When the Bible talks about hunting, it's not necessarily talking about hunting animals. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 24 and just give you a couple of examples. And there's many examples in the scripture. 1 Samuel 24 and verse 11. This is when David encounters Saul's encampment and spares his life. He says in verse 11, "Moreover, my father, see the skirt of thy robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the skirt of thy robe and killed thee not, know thou and see that there is neither evil nor transgression in mine hand. And I have not sinned against thee, yet thou huntest my soul to take it." Hunting can mean hunting people. It can mean hunting souls. Another one is, you don't have to turn here, it's just one verse. It's Proverbs 6, in verse 26. I'm just going to read that. A little bit different context, but he's talking about the strange woman. He says, "Lest not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids. For by means of a whorish woman, a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life." Okay, so hunting doesn't always mean hunting beasts. It can mean hunting men. It can mean hunting souls. And when I actually did some research into this, I read some different articles and passages about this, and I also asked ChatGPT, which I do quite a bit these days since it's a tool that's available, and it kind of came up with a similar thought that, like, the fact that it says he's a mighty hunter doesn't necessarily mean a hunter of animals. It very well could be referring to his lust for power and conquest. This guy was a conqueror, and he went out conquering people and conquering nations and assembling a kingdom. It also says that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, what exactly does that mean? We see this phrase about being before God back in Genesis 7, when the Lord said unto Noah, "Come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation." So that's how God saw Noah. He saw him as being righteous. That was God's perspective. "I've seen thee righteous before me." Nimrod was nothing like Noah. But still, it says that he was before God. That's also an interesting phrase. Because in Exodus chapter 20, verse 3, in the Ten Commandments, the first commandment is, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other gods before me. So it could also be just kind of a description of preeminence. This guy Nimrod was exalting himself against God. He was a rebel. And we're going to see that also in the next chapter, although it doesn't mention Nimrod by name. There's some interesting things about Nimrod. I'm going to actually read a page from this book that I have here. It's called The Two Babylons. I don't know if anybody's ever read it or read part of it. But it's basically a book that asserts and pretty much proves that the religious system of the Roman Catholic Church is taken from the ancient religion of Babylon. And it pretty much started with this guy Nimrod. And that's the assertion that he's making. But I just want to read one page that's kind of about Nimrod and about who he very likely is. So I'm just going to read this. It says, now this Ninus, or sun, born in the arms of the Babylonian Madonna, is so described as very clearly to identify him with Nimrod. So he's talking about this figure, historical figure known as Ninus. He was called that. I think it's from Greek history that he was referred to. But basically, with him and his wife, they kind of started this idea of mother-child worship and making themselves out to be deities. But he goes on to kind of explain the association here. So he says, he's so described as to very clearly identify him with Nimrod. Ninus, king of the Assyrians, says Trogus Pompeius, epitomized by Justin, first of all, changed the contented moderation of the ancient manners, incited by a new passion, the desire of conquest. He was the first who carried on war against his neighbors, and he conquered all nations from Assyria to Libya, as they were yet unacquainted with the arts of war. That makes sense. They just got off the ark. They're trying to put lives together and, you know, build families and start farms and everything. And here this guy comes along, starts conquering them because they don't know war yet. This account points directly to Nimrod and can apply to no other. The account of Diodorus Siculus entirely agrees with it and adds another trait that goes still further to determine the identity. That account is as follows. Ninus, the most ancient of the Assyrian kings mentioned in history, performed great actions. Being naturally of a warlike disposition and ambitious of glory that results from valor, he armed a considerable number of young men that were brave and vigorous like himself, trained them up a long time in laborious exercises and hardships, and by that means accustomed them to bear the fatigues of war and to face dangers with intrepidity. As Diodorus makes Ninus the most ancient of the Assyrian kings and represents him as beginning those wars which raised his power to an extraordinary height by bringing the people of Babylonia under subjection to him, while as yet the city of Babylon was not in existence, this shows that he occupied the very position of Nimrod, of whom the scriptural account is that he first began to be mighty on the earth, and that the beginning of his kingdom was Babylon. As the Babel builders, when their speech was confounded, were scattered abroad on the face of the earth and therefore deserted both the city and the tower which they had commenced to build, Babylon as a city could not properly be said to exist till Nimrod, by establishing his power there, made it the foundation and starting point of his greatness. In this respect, then, the story of Ninus and of Nimrod exactly harmonize. The way, too, in which Ninus gained his power is the very way in which Nimrod erected his. There could be no doubt that it was by inuring his followers to the toils and dangers of the chase that he gradually formed them to the use of arms and so prepared them for aiding him in establishing his dominions, just as Ninus, by training his companions for a long time in laborious exercises and hardships, qualified them for making him the first of the Assyrian kings. It's fascinating reading. It's a little bit difficult, but this guy is a true scholar. He's got like six entire pages just filled with the references that he consulted to write this book. This guy Nimrod, if he's the same as this Ninus that he's describing, who was the supposedly the founder of Nineveh, or Nineveh, he's also connected with the foundation of these false religions and the introduction of false gods. At this point, you've got eight people. They just get off the ark. They know who the true God is. He's the one that just told them to build an ark, and he wiped out the rest of the world. Now you're only a few generations removed from that, and people start to depart from the knowledge of God. And in order to do that, like this guy Nimrod, he gets a following. He's creating a kingdom. He wants people to follow him. In order to do that, he's got to get them to not follow the true God. So what does he do? Is he starts creating this false religion. Makes himself out to be a deity. Makes his wife out to be a deity. And that's how you do it, I guess. Because they clearly were not interested in following the true God. We're going to see more of this in the next chapter. These two chapters are kind of like, they're not really sequential. It's not like Genesis 10 happened before Genesis 11. Genesis 10 is more of an overview, just kind of going over the different tribes. Just to continue on here. It says in verse, I just want to mention the kingdom. So verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calne in the land of Shinar. Shinar is over here. And you can see on the map, I just have Nimrod because he's one of the sons that were mentioned here. But in this exact area, the world believes that there was a kingdom here, and they call it the first civilization. They call it Sumer, the Sumerians. And it is most likely the kingdom that Nimrod built, which was the very first kingdom. Verse 11, out of that land went forth Asher and builded Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah. So there's kind of some debate about this verse. There's a lot of people, and actually it says in the side note, or in the marginal note by the King James translators, he went out into Assyria. So some people understand this to mean that it was Nimrod that went forth out of that land, possibly after what happened in Genesis 11 with the Tower of Babel, which we'll get into next time. But that he went out from this land, which is here, to Assyria, which is up here, not that far away, and then built these other cities. Another possibility is, and this would be a more literal reading, is that it says, out of that land went forth Asher. Well, who's Asher? Well, actually, if you go down and you start getting to Shem, in verse 22, Asher is one of the children of Shem. So, but it's kind of out of place in verse 11, because why are we talking about Asher? We're talking about the sons of Ham. Asher's not even one of the sons of Ham. We're actually talking about Nimrod. And we don't even get to the next son of Ham, which is Mizraim, until the following verse, verse 13. So we're still kind of in the context of talking about the sons of Cush, which is Nimrod. So this definitely has something to do with Nimrod, but here's another possibility, is that when God confounded the languages and he spread out these nations, because they were all kind of huddled over here,
is that Asher left that land and built Assyria.
Now, if you go to Micah chapter 5, Micah chapter 5. Now, the name Assyria is from the name Asher, so it would make total sense. Asher went over and founded a land that was named after him, right? Okay. If I can find Micah here. Micah chapter 5 and verse 6, it says, "And they shall waste the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod in the entrances thereof. Thus shall he deliver us from the Assyrian, when he cometh into our land, and when he treadeth within our borders." So it makes it very clear Assyria is also the land of Nimrod. So how is this possible? Is it the one or is it the other? Did Nimrod come from this land over here and build all these cities in Assyria? Or was it Asher that came from the Tower of Babel after it was dispersed and came over here and started all this Assyria stuff? I think it was both, honestly. I think it's in the context of Nimrod that we're talking about because it's very closely connected with him. It starts with this land of Shinar. That's where Nimrod had the root of this thing. And I think from there, Asher left, and he was part of this system. And from there, I think Asher was possibly even like one of his henchmen or one of his leaders that goes out and expands his kingdom into that area, and that's why it's called Assyria. But it's still the land of Nimrod. I think he was the ringleader there. So that's just kind of my thoughts on that. But let's move on from here. We can't spend all day talking about Nimrod. Okay, so verse 13. "And Mizraim begat Ludim, and Anamim, and Lehabim, and Naphtuhim, and Pathrusim and Kesluhim, out of whom came Philistim." Now, most of these names don't really mean a lot to you, but Philistim is significant. Philistim is over here. It's kind of interesting. It's like right where that Gaza Strip is. It's in the news all the time. Because Philistim is whom the Philistines came from, which are today known as Palestinians. The name Palestine actually comes from that name, Philistim. You can find that in the Bible, that it talks about both. And what do you know? They inhabit the exact same place where the Philistines inhabited in the Bible. It even talks about the same cities. That's who the Palestinians are. And here's the root that I was talking about right here. Philistim. So then verse 15, and you start getting into the tribes of the Canaanites. And Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn. That Sidon is one of the main cities of Lebanon today. It's actually still there. And it's named after the guy who probably founded it, Sidon, who is the son of Canaan here. Begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. Heth, I believe, is the father of the Hittites, and I think it kind of hints at that later on when you talk about how Abraham was negotiating with the children of the sons of Heth, and one of them was Ephron the Hittite. So Heth, the Hittites were in this area up here, kind of the south of Turkey or the north of Canaan there, and they were the sons of Heth. And then he goes from talking about individual names, the names of these sons, to now he talks about entire tribes. Hey, Canaan begets Sidon and Heth. These are actually people's names, and the Jebusite. I start getting into tribes, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. He's saying, again, Moses is talking to Israel. He's writing this book for the children of Israel, and he's explaining where these different tribes that they were all familiar with came from. And they're going from Egypt into the land of Canaan and encountering all these tribes. And Moses is basically saying, hey, you guys know all about these Amorites, the Hivites, and all these guys. And he's saying, this is where they started. All these ites, they all came from this Canaan guy. And these tribes, a lot of them, you can search through the Bible and you can find how they played out in different scenarios and the impact that they had on the children of Israel. Okay, finally, we get to verse 20. Actually, also another thing that's mentioned here is the border of the Canaanites. It says, was from verse 19, was from Sidon, as thou comest to Gerar, unto Gaza, as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboam, even unto Lasha. It's significant. He mentions Sodom and Gomorrah here. Again, where were we just a chapter ago? We saw what happened with Ham. And whatever exactly he did, I'm not sure about. But one thing was for sure, he was a pervert. And his son, Canaan, which is who we're talking about here, was cursed because of what Ham did and because of the way his father was. So what you see is that that seed was planted, that seed of sexual perversion, basically, in Genesis 9. And then you get to 10 and you start talking about that same guy's descendants. And here you have Sodom and Gomorrah, which later on in Genesis are going to be destroyed by fire and brimstone from God because of their perversion. So you can see how it starts with a little seed, and then it grows, and then it spreads to the point that God's like, you know what? It's so wicked, I'm just going to take it out. But that's what this chapter is for, to show you those origins and where these things come from. Okay, verse 21. Unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth, the elder, even to him were children is born. So a couple things here. This is how you know the order of the sons. Japheth is called the elder. In the previous chapter, Ham was called the younger. So if Japheth's the elder and Ham is the younger, then that makes Shem the one in the middle. But he's kind of listed at the end here. We start with Japheth in this chapter, then go on to Ham, and then we finish up with Shem, because Shem is the line that Moses is going to continue talking about throughout the rest of this book. Because it's that line, the line of Shem, from whom Israel is going to come eventually.
Right.
In a few chapters, we'll see that. So, and he says in verse 21, unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. If you look at that in the New Testament, that name Eber is called Heber. And it kind of hints at who Eber is. He's the father of the Hebrews. Okay. And that's why he specifically mentions Eber here, because Moses is trying to bring this to attention to the Hebrews. He's trying to teach them where they came from. verse 22, the children of Shem, Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. And again, you can consult the map and just kind of see who these different tribes are. Elam is well known by historians to be Persia. I was just reading about it today. I read an entire article where they keep talking about the ancient kingdom of Elam was the Persians, you know, and they go on and on and on. And they don't even acknowledge in the whole article anything about this chapter. They don't even acknowledge the Bible, but they still know that kingdom was Elam. I thought that was very interesting. Asher, we talked about a little bit. He's the father of Assyria. Aram, I think, is the Syrians. Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash. Narphaxad begat Selah, and Selah begat Eber, so that's where Eber is. And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided. That phrase, it could be either referring to the way that the nations were dispersed in the next chapter at the Tower of Babel, or it could even possibly be talking about a division of the earth itself. There's a lot of people who believe that the earth was previously one giant continent. They refer to it as Pangaea, and that's also a possibility. they might have happened at the same time. That there could have been this one massive supercontinent that God actually divided, and that's why we have these different continents around the world today. So that's just a possibility that I wanted to mention there. Verse 26, and Joktan begat Almodad, and Sheleph, and Hazarmaveth, and Jera, and Hadoram, and Uzal, and Dikla, and Obal, and Abimael, and Sheba, and Ophir, and Havilah, and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. And on the map, some of the names, like Havilah, you're going to notice that there's two of them. There's one here, and then there's another one up here. Again, I don't know if these are actually where they were. This is just kind of a guess or an estimation. But there were actually two Havilahs, because one is one of the children of Shem, and another one that we already mentioned was one of the children of Ham. So they're definitely two different people, and they most likely didn't settle in the same place just because they had the same name, right? Okay. Verse 30, and their dwelling was from Mesha as thou goest unto Sephar, a mount of the east. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations. And by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. Okay, that is Genesis 10. I know we're going a little bit long here, so I thank you for your patience. Again, check out the map. I think it's pretty interesting in terms of just where the different nations are that were pretty significant in the old world there, in especially in the Middle East. And you can learn some good biblical history by just studying this chapter and looking at the map. So with that, just thank you all for being in Sunday school.